Welcome everyone to a new episode of the FinOps Weekly Podcast, and today we are going to try and put you more actionable topics and more actionable insights into the table for improving your FinOps practice at your company. And to help us with that, we have Amit Kina, the field CTO of Doit. Amit, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Pleasure, pleasure to have you, and I'm sure that you're going to help us a lot driving actionable FinOps to our community. So without further ado, let's start. So Amit, we have seen that, you know, there is a lot of talk about the FinOps culture. How do you get the FinOps started going, and how do you start in your company? But in your experience, and since your own experience in FinOps, what does a good FinOps culture look like in a company?
Yeah, good question. I think it really depends on where the company is in their cloud maturity. I think oftentimes a FinOps team or a person will start out of necessity, right? Mm-hmm. What I call is like when you have a FinOps moment, you realize that the cloud cost after your L0 estimates was say $1,000, and then you get the bill and it was 8,000, and immediately, you know, everyone jumps into how could this have happened? What can we do differently? Find the whack-a-mole, you know, where the cost is going. And I think now at least FinOps is becoming a thing that's becoming essential towards any cloud practice, at least in a large enterprise. But, you know, oftentimes I think about there's no right or wrong way to start, right? There isn't this playbook that says, if you're this size company, you must start with, you know, X, Y, and Z. If you're a smaller company, do X and Y. And I think it's because you really have to figure out what are your priorities, right? I think looking at the framework sometimes of FinOps, it's very daunting, right? There's so many different capabilities. There's so many different scopes. And every 6 months, there's something else added. And I think oftentimes it's overlooked that, well, FinOps doesn't exist to just be a function on its own. It's real to help drive business outcomes. And so for me, a healthy practice in a large enterprise would be, you know, I think what I've seen work really well is a hub and spoke model where you have a centralized FinOps team mm-hmm. that's focused on, you know, a very specific group of things, including enablement of the platform, you know, outreach, understanding and teaching engineers and other folks about cost. But then you also have the spoke where is the actual, you know, engineering teams or the product teams or procurement, all the other different personas, and they are getting the relevant information they care about at the right time so they can make almost better decisions, right? I think that's a holy grail mm-hmm. of a healthy practice. And, you know, there's a complementary nature towards optimization where the centralized team is focused on things of either governance, right, preventing things that they don't want in their company. For example, in non-production using on-demand instances, we might be a company that says spot instances only in our test environment. And downstream, it would be around efficiency in, say, Kubernetes, right? Only the downstream mm-hmm. team that's actually developing their platform or application would know how much memory and CPU they really require. So, you know, to me, that's that, especially in large enterprises, that makes the most sense.
That's cool. Yeah, I think the hub and spoke model is one of the best models, especially if you have like a CCOE team or you are a large enterprise. It works really great for that type. And it's kind of the ideal, I would say, for mostly everyone that has enough size. So, okay, so now that we know that this is the, let's say, the desired model and how things should work, what do you think are the main challenges or the main barriers that prevents this from happening in companies?
Yeah, so I think oftentimes there's, in the beginning, the getting executive buy-in is often overlooked where, you know, on surface, I think FinOps is often heard and thought about as an optimization play, right? Hey, mm-hmm. it's the goal of FinOps is to reduce cost, right? If I'm spending this much, I want to spend less. And I think that misses the forest for the trees in a way that oftentimes it's not really about that. It's more about getting visibility about what you're spending and using cloud costs as an advantage towards making better decisions, right? To me, effective FinOps practice will enable businesses to understand we can go in this market, right? So if you have a different region you want to enable, the cost of it, we have confidence will be this much. We can track the ROI of why we're in this market. And it really helps you speed up getting your products out faster versus being seen as this, you know, this thing that's it's a cost center that's, and the only purpose of the FinOps team is to lower that cost. So oftentimes that when the executives may feel that's the point of FinOps, it's almost swimming upstream to kind of define out, well, why do we need tagging and, cost attribution and efficiency, when they're like, well, my goal is for you to lower the bill, right? So oftentimes it's getting the executive buy-in to understand what is FinOps, what is the point? And beyond this, of course, optimization is a really big thing, don't get me wrong, but there's so much more value add you can prevent or give to especially on your engineering front, to help them make better decisions about architecture, about applications, about back testing and everything else there.
Yeah, that's totally true. I think those barriers need to be broken, and of course, like executive buy-in as anything helps a lot. I would say, especially in bigger companies, to let's say accelerate the practice
Totally.
and start improving that for sure. So okay, so now that we know like how it would looks like, how the barriers that people need to check, like. Once you are, working on your culture and on your adoption, how are you, or how is someone able to measure that it's making progress? How do you see that? Which metrics or which topic could you, let's say, measure to know that you are on the right track?
Yeah, good question. I think to me, FinOps is really a data science problem, masquerading as another thing. So if I imagine like if I'm in a, and again, it's easier to think about larger enterprises where there's more complexity, right? In a smaller company, of course, it's much easier to not have to worry about attributing costs to different products or business units, right? But any medium-sized enterprise where you have multiple competing things that are driving revenue, products, for lack of a better word. You first step to me is always about, well, let's track that, right? Where is the spend coming from? And I think that's where, what I call FinOps 1.0 was really focused on, this idea of we have N number of AWS accounts and we have a payer account, and every month we get a bill and it's always a shock, right? It's either too low and we're like, oh wow, we didn't spend as much, and it turns out it was February, so it's only 28 days, or it's way too high and you're looking back to say, who did this, right? And so being able to attribute cost to the actual teams or products that are being delivered, to me, is the first step in getting there. And then beyond that, I think oftentimes it's about, okay, well, just the cost alone is not enough, right? Being able to add the context of your business. I think this is where we think about like unit economics, right, is really important. How do we actually ascertain this cost is not in isolation, but it was because it led to this either growth or this new market or this revenue or daily active users or whatever the company may care about there. So being able to do that first and foremost to me is like the foundation of everything else you build on top of it.
No, that's totally true, and that's a good point that you raise about, the unit economics. I think it's a topic that is mentioned a lot, and I consider also that has like a lot of help to get the management and the business get involved into the practice. And talking about it, moving on. The visibility of that. So unit economics, when there are a lot of things that you can measure, there are a lot of KPIs that you can use. What do you think makes a specific unit economic more actionable so that you can do actually things or you can take action based on that? Whatever is just a visible thing that you can, show
Yeah.
and measure something, but when you want to see something that is more actionable.
I think in any environment where the cost, or rather the business is dynamic, right, it makes a lot of sense to be able to tie it. And I think, for example, if you're a retail business and in America, if you have Black Friday right after Thanksgiving where everyone's shopping, and without knowing that, say you get a cost anomaly alert that's just focused on cost being higher, right? It's a simple machine learning model that says, we think there's an anomaly, and you get this alert. An engineer wakes up and freaks out about it because they think, oh my God, something's wrong. We're spending 80% more today than we have yesterday. But in isolation, that would happen. But to me, unit economics helps prevent that because you add the business context of, well, why is this occurring, right? So if you know, for example, well, we can get near real-time data about the amount of things we're selling or daily active users on an application, or like imagine an iOS app that gets on TechCrunch and your company's really happy and everyone's clicking to log into it and signing up. Well, with that, if you don't know that, of course you're going to have an anomaly, right? You're going to have this like analysis done of like something's really wrong, and be like, no, this is a feature, not a bug. This is a good thing, right? So to me, unit economics really helps bring that context along for the ride, right? Especially when you get closer and closer to real time, it gives you confidence that your cloud spend is not, again, just this thing that we have to manage to keep low at all times. You want to be able to see, for example, hey, we doubled our revenue. However, the cost for cloud only went up 1.2x, right? There's a log function in play, the scale of economics or whatever there. So being able to contextualize the data with the metrics you care about, depending on the business. And oftentimes, I think what ends up happening is when we talk about unit economics, the centralized team in the hub and spoke model we're describing sometimes feels responsible for onloading this data, right? And to me, it's really difficult, right? Because especially if you're in a larger company, the product owners are really the ones who understand what is the metric they care about. What is the definition of success and failure of their product is the thing that you should be measuring. Because to me, the cloud cost is at what cost are we successful, right? So I think along those lines. And then on the other side is if you're doing any sort of a B2B, for example, and you want to price out your product, understanding, well, at what cost does this take? So being able to, for example, figure out you have certain customers that are paying very little but are spending a lot of money on your platform, it'd be helpful for you to understand whether we have to set rate limits for them, or for a net new product, we should price it at this price point because otherwise we're throwing money away, so to speak, there.
Totally understood. I also think, like, even though we were discussing the other day that unit economics that are actionable for your business or that are more applicable to your business are more difficult to calculate than cost per CPU or things like that, they are much more valuable because they relate actually to business and not something that is more, let's say, generic, that is the cost per CPU, which is something that, yeah, it could be measured, but it's not something that could guide you to to the general results or the general impact, I would say, to the company itself, which is probably the most important thing that you should link it into. Talking a bit about the unit economics and something that is very related to measuring and metrics is the observability, right? So observability is something that is very into industries and cultures of the DevOps side and the security side, right? There is a lot of work on observability for handling tickets, for anomalies, for issues in that. So how do you see this convergence or this union of FinOps with observability in terms of, like, how do you approach that in the cost optimization side, and how it's, in your case, or how you have seen in customers leveraging the observability to do better FinOps?
Yeah, great question. It's funny, like on AWS, for example, the CUR file that we all, just refer to is a cost and usage report. And oftentimes we always lack the latter, right? And the Venn diagram of that's FinOps to me is like usability data of metrics around utilization is equally important as a cost data, right? And to me, like this, these three circles of business context with cost data, with usage data is how you have effective FinOps practice. So for example, I'll use EC2s or VMs, for example, right? If you see something spending $10 an hour, oftentimes you may get context around, okay, well, maybe we want to right size. The way you really know whether to right size is because you have utilization data around the memory and CPU, right? You're able to kind of figure out, well, we're really only running 20% of the CPU usage that we have, and then we're only using 30% of the memory. And a lot of these platforms will give you a generic link or generic insight that says, hey, downsize your thing, right? You're throwing money away at the problem there. To me, like, and then the next level of beyond that would be if you think about something like number of API calls that are coming in, right? We start to blend observability data around metrics specifically in order to be able to help contextualize the unit economics of it, and not so for example, if you can get the number of API calls that are occurring, you can understand, hey, per million API calls, like unit cost is actually going down and down. We're getting more efficient with it, versus just in isolation, the cost going down to be able to attribute why is it occurring. And then you can have as benchmarks for engineers to say, well, we're more than happy to launch these things, but we want to have a sprint where we're focusing on lowering this cost per million API calls, right? The other side, I think observability data is really helpful, is around some of the more complex systems we have, like Kubernetes, right? In isolation, you may say that, back to my EC2 example, your memory is underutilized and your CPU is underutilized at the node level. Great. And you surface this insight to an engineering team, DevOps, and they say, well, this doesn't apply to me. We're not spinning up VMs on our own. We're using EKS or GKE to spin up the VM automatically. And we can't really change it. And the reason we can't change is because everyone's setting their pod limits to, say, 4 gigs when they really needed 2, right? So to be able to understand the next level of observability data to say, well, at the Kubernetes layer, these are your workloads, and these workloads are not right-sized. And in order to be the most efficient, you don't have to worry about buying a savings plan or an RI or a CUD. You don't have to worry about spinning up and down the different size of nodes. You should fix actual memory and CPU request limits, right? So I think being able to contextualize the FinOps data, it's impossible without adding in some of the observability level data. And the last step place would be, I think, when there's anomalies, right? Whenever some issue occurs they didn't want to happen, at that point, oftentimes what we give today to engineers would be, hey, there's a cost spike, figure it out, right? And so now the engineers, running around looking at, for example, did we do a release yesterday? Did we have more people come into the platform? Did we have what occurred that caused this to happen? Was there a config update? Whatever. So being able to use observability data to kind of give as much context as possible when we do alert our engineers or whoever for these issues that occur, it helps them get to the last mile of, yep, this is an actual issue and I can trace it really quickly and I can now automate the fix of it, either roll back or whatever. Otherwise, it becomes this thing of like you give them a symptom, the cost is higher, but you don't give them the actual data of like, well, why do we think that actually happened?
Yeah, that's totally true. And I agree, especially on the Kubernetes side, like there are a lot of factors. It's a complex thing and it's always been, but I think the FinOps part helps a lot on one topic that was the right sizing of the limits and the request that was like totally forgotten by people because it's difficult. Like it's trial and error most things unless you have like a tool to help you on that. It's basically very difficult to see the real consumption depending on the scenario and it's very tricky. But it helped especially for me like being measured and now there are tools and native both native and third party tools that help you see more what are the consumption of the workload is in respect to their request, which is like the magic I would say one of the magic things to check when you are working with Kubernetes to help you in FinOps for sure.
It's interesting. We actually have a platform called Perfect Scale, and that's the entire concept that it's very difficult for engineers to kind of go and say every PR you make, every time you merge a request, the memory footprint is going to change slightly, right? Every time you upgrade a library, even. And so getting engineers to either do performance testing on every merge, right? And say, I don't need 4 gigs blanket, I need 2.9. Or I don't need 2 CPUs, I need 1.8. It's very impossible to do that, especially at scale, right? And I think being able to do that automatically in lower environments and being able to add a buffer to say, hey, you know what? Sample the number, the actual observability data and make the changes on my behalf, right? With a buffer on top of it for higher environments like production, whatever. So for us, Perfect Scale is one of those things that I think anyone who's used Kubernetes finds this is an actual issue that is impossible to solve for. And we don't want to be doing this manually, right? We don't want to have a team of support people or SREs or DevOps wasting their time trying to profile and continuously update. It's like a game of whack-a-mole that's impossible. So for us, it's one of those things that, especially in the larger Kubernetes environments, I can't imagine a world in a couple of years from now where people are trying to do this manually going forward.
Yeah, I totally agree. I would say like especially in a sector targeting to DevOps, which there is a lot of tools, both like enterprise, open source, and all of that. There will be probably the best automation on that side to help you right size your workload as soon as possible and take into account that as mentioned, the engineers' decision are cost decisions in cloud, and you need to adjust dynamically whether or not depending on your Java workload, Python workloads. It really
Exactly.
depends on whether or not which language and a lot of things that it's difficult for I would say an engineer to have in mind. Like every time that you do a PR, which you probably have an urgency to deliver the feature to your deadline, so that will help a lot to increase the workflow, same as a topic that we'll discuss, which is AI and how it helps you with the productivity.
I think
And
that on that point of though about the engineers, it's so funny. We always talk about shift left. We say engineers should care, like have more data up front. They should shift left. So cost data becomes a decision point for architecture, which I completely agree with. But there's certain things we don't want to shift left on. We don't want to give engineers more and more things to worry about when they're like, dude, I just want to make my application that's resilient, that doesn't go down, scales well. And now I have to worry about setting CPU limits on every PR. It's, at a certain point, it's just too many things. And to me, the automation side of, for example, Kubernetes is, it sounds scary at first, right? You're like, you're going to trust a company to adjust my things on the fly. And then my counterpoint is always like, well, if you use any sort of autoscaling group or use Carpenter, for example, you're already kind of doing that, right? You're already allowing some system to understand your profile and be able to spin up nodes and spin down nodes. That's the entire point of Kubernetes, right? So to me, like something that's auto right sizing your memory and CPU limits, it's just the next iteration of that, right? That why are you doing these things manually? Otherwise, you could be running 24 by 7, for example, if you didn't trust autoscaling groups. So getting people comfortable with this big scary word called automation and saying, well, it's not this like, you know, like an AI that's meant automatically doing things in the ether. It's just another level of abstraction so you can focus on your application and not necessarily configuration.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, you need to focus on the features, you need to focus on the business logic. That is something that you can only do, and then leave the, let's say, more general lower level task to automation and AI, because if you can delegate that, the more value that you will provide to people. And you know, like, linking to the topic of AI, which is, you know, a hot topic in every area of business, I want you to ask to help the people enlighten a bit of like the use of AI in FinOps. So from your experience, from your customers' experience, from what you have seen, where do you think is AI making the biggest impact in FinOps today, and where do you think is overhyped and has no use?
Interesting. Yeah. So, you know, there's two parts to it, I guess. There's the AI for FinOps, and then there's FinOps for AI itself. So if we double click into the first one, you know, AI for FinOps, I think the biggest use case for that is getting the right data to the right person at the right time. Oftentimes I feel like, you know, FinOps 1.0 was all about, hey, let's build dashboards. We can show you data, right? We can aggregate your stuff together. We can load some things. FinOps 2.0 was like, okay, we can add more context, right? We can have, you know, utilization metrics. We'll give you generic insights, really. We'll help you figure out that, you know, for example, hey, Graviton processors, you must use that. And your company says, we don't do that. Or the nodes thing I was describing, or on and on and on. And to me, the FinOps 3.0 paradigm that we're, you know, at Doit are really considering is that we want to give actionable data to the right relevant people. And that persona really is important. The CFO or the CTO does not need to see attributions of their costs. They want to understand, well, where's my money going at the largest level? Where is the forecast going to be? What is the OpEx that I'm looking at here? And to me, with AI, it's really helpful to be able to kind of ask the question in English, right? Be able to say, hey, what I care about is this. And be able to iterate on it, saying, hey, can you help me load my business context data as well? Right. So we have a, you know, we have Ava, we refer to, which is our AI for FinOps tool, which really helps customers understand in English what the problem they're trying to solve for and will help you get there. So I think instead of having to, you know, click a bunch of buttons to get to some dashboard, export the report into Excel, and then whatever, why can't you just ask about that in English? And then beyond that, imagine being able to say, for example, I want to prevent my interns from spinning up the P5 instances of NVIDIA because it's $100 an hour. Before, you might have to build a guardrail, you have to connect it and everything else. So I think being able to now take that, turn into Terraform, be able to apply an OPA policy to it to prevent that from occurring automatically is the power for, you know, FinOps for AI for FinOps there. On the FinOps for AI side, oh, go ahead.
No.
Oh.
Please continue on the other side.
Yeah, so FinOps for AI, it's interesting. It's a challenge that I was also facing when I was running FinOps at Citibank. We were using Vertex AI, and it's very similar to what I feel like Kubernetes was 8 years ago, where it's a black box, right? You get one cost l line item. It's, you know, for the API calls you're making to Vertex or Gemini or whatever. And it's very hard to figure out, well, is this a good amount of cost? Should it be higher or lower? Who do we attribute it back to? Right. So it's similar to when you had multiple workloads running in one Kubernetes cluster. Right. Now, in order to get cost attribution, the terrible way of doing it is saying, hey, let's create a new cluster for every single use case. You kind of lose the entire point of using Kubernetes at that point. And similarly, in, you know, in this in the AI landscape, oftentimes, I think FinOps for AI, you know, what people might turn to say, well, we want to be able to have our five use cases have their own different cost. let's make five different AWS accounts or GCP projects and connect them. And then when we have to come, we have when we need like a provision throughput request or anything, do we now kind of combine them together? Who pays for it? Right? Very similar concept to what we're in Kubernetes. So being able to solve for that to me is similar to what we did in Kubernetes. We'll have to create an agent, probably. That'll be a very crawl, walk, run approach as well. Right? Initially, it might be that we have something that can attribute who was the API caller. Did it come from within specific? Can we tag that somehow? Right? Can we have an agent that's almost like a toll booth that's tracking this metadata, and then be able to attribute it back to specific business units? A walk approach might be that at that point, and we are no longer satisfied with saying, hey, that $1 million a month is going to these two teams. Are we efficient or not? Right. So maybe we are able to add context to analyze the prompt itself that was sent forward and look at the model that was used and say, yeah, look, you're asking for the weather and you're using the most multimodal frontier model available from OpenAI. Probably don't need to use that there. Right. And then for me, the run approach would be, well, similar to the GPT-5 that just came out recently, we don't want to be in the business of choosing models. We don't want to be in the business of cleaning up our prompts. I think there was a joke that was early this summer that, people saying thank you to OpenAI is causing $20 million in excess run because everyone just keeps saying thank you after over and over again. Or in more serious notes, like places where in an embedding model, right, a RAG would be much more efficient than loading the entire context into the window and passing it forward and just doing that automatically. So similar to what I was describing, perfect scale of choosing memory and CPU limits, the run approach for FinOps for AI is engineers and anyone using AI in their company is just asking whatever they need, and the optimization is being done on the fly automatically there as well.
Yeah, that's true. I think those examples are very, illustrative of saying like, where the cost is going, and you can lose a lot of money for a thank you message or for something that you haven't taken into account. And of course, the idea would be to, be having and being able to have that on the fly. So where do you think this, like the automation with AI versus the human judgment, where do you think that will be like the perfect integration of both, like in a run, let's say a scenario? Where do you envision that?
It's interesting. We do believe that right now the FinOps without a human in the loop is very difficult to, get the full context and understanding of what is actually occurring and what are the business priorities that you're trying to tackle. If you look at the capabilities in FinOps framework, there's a lot of them. And oftentimes it's very difficult for someone just getting started in FinOps to be like, well, what do I need to prioritize today? Right? Is it does the business really care about optimization? It might be that we're in growth mode and we're like, look, we'll solve that problem later. Right now, we just want to have cost available to us per user, per consumer, whatever, in order to be able to now charge properly for it or be able to show our run rate effectively. Whereas a much more established practice might be like, okay, we've done the build out, we're in production, let's be more efficient now. And that's what we're going to index on. So I think with a human, I don't think anytime soon we're going to have a place where we say, you know what, we don't need humans anymore. We're just going to run fully AI, FinOps is a solved problem. Because contextually speaking, FinOps is not just about the efficiency, right? We might get AI to help us solve more and more of these efficiency problems of, choosing the right node or choosing the right configurations for these different tools, helping you with architecture of saying your web application does not need Kubernetes, it should be running on a Lambda. You have 100 users, you don't need to do that. But where I think a human in the loop is still very important is to kind of understand what is a business needs in that moment and how can we use leverage FinOps in order to drive that business forward, right? Be able to contextualize and say, the DAU that we care about of get doubling our daily active users for the next year is our goal. Okay, well, we don't want to blow up the bank and literally just do this in a hard-coded way of, hey, we have four different, different regions running. We can do piecemeal. So be able to connect that together with the cost data in FinOps, to me, it still requires this context of a human understanding, right? Granted, it might be something that, a human is using AI to translate to FinOps objectives, and that is being loaded into some platform that is then helping them track those objectives. But, on the efficiency side, I can see AI taking more and more of saying, well, why are you worrying about this manually? But at least on the other parts of FinOps, which is, justifying, showing business value, justifying the cost, being able to be more efficient and use that, savings as leverage to play in the spaces that you necessarily would have thought we don't have budget for, right? All those things still require a human, in my opinion.
I think that's totally correct, and yeah, it's a very good use of, where do you should put your limitation and where you should be in the automation flow, because as always, I think all the automation is welcome, and whether, on the big decision that affects the business, then is where you need humans to take the decision and take the responsibility. And, also talking about human factor, which I think is one of the, if not the most important thing in FinOps. So there is a, normally companies start, or I think most of us have experimented that FinOps in general starts with a cost cutting thing. Like you are spending a lot, then you need to cut cost, and then from there we shift towards value optimization. And related to business and saying like growing business and not shrinking the cost only, and that's it. So how have you seen like customers, teams, people, friends from the community be able to actually change that mindset in their companies to from cost cutting to a value thing?
Yeah, excellent question. And I often joke that especially in the larger practices where you have a team, not necessarily one person, I'm sure the CTO or CFO is thinking the best way to save money and cost is just fire the whole team, right? And all of a sudden we have these savings that we didn't have before. I think that being able to flip that mindset, it's not necessarily even a flip, it's more of adding context, right? Being able to say that, articulate that. I think the underlying thing that a lot of executives may feel, or the leadership may feel, is that we don't really know whether this is the best use of our money, right? And what I mean by that is, you give AWS or GCP or any of these providers, even SaaS vendors, a certain amount of pay-as-you-go money, right? But you don't have a, there's no quantifiable way of saying, but is this the most efficient way we can do something? Right. So oftentimes it may be that, hey, cut 20% because I actually don't know what the reference number is. So we just choose a number. And oftentimes, whenever you put the pressure on your development teams to save the 20%, well, somehow they do it. Right. It happens again and again and again. Eventually you're like, okay. So every time my engineer tells me that, no, this is the only way to do something in cloud, and I put them to the test, they magically find a way. You start to erode that trust in, no, this is the best version of our platform and the non-functional requirements we have. This is the most efficient way of doing something, right? And being able to now find that target value, and for example, in Kubernetes, it's easy because you can say, well, short of looking at the actual application itself, we're using just the right amount of memory and CPU, and we have a savings plan on top of the nodes that we're using, and the nodes we're using are right size because of Carpenter. You get to get trust in the system to say, this is the most efficient way of doing something that we're doing, right? So all of a sudden you change that mindset from cost optimization and really more about efficiency, right? That every dollar that you give to an AWS or GCP, you're getting the maximum value back in return, right? And I think getting that flywheel effect of getting building that trust of, we're not just, in a playground where we're using the bright, shiny objects, which one of my least favorite things about the FinOps industry is when someone says engineers don't care about FinOps. And I'm like, I don't think that's true. I don't think they have the right tools, or they have the right data, or the right context to care about FinOps. Of course, every person wants to be running as efficiently as possible. But when you flip it to say, hey, instead of saving money, can you find more efficiency in the platform? Because it's very complicated. I know there's multiple ways of doing something in cloud. Engineers take that on as a challenge. And I think being able to show those efficiency gains of either by unit economics of per million API calls or daily active users that we're driving the cost lower and lower and lower, right? I think that is the name of the game versus, a generic top line item that says, save me 20% overnight.
Yeah, that's totally true, and that affirmation of the FinOps not caring is probably there is not enough incentive, or there is other things that are affecting of why there is less priority on that. And talking about tools and data and that stuff, I would like to to talk a bit briefly about the Focus ecosystem. I know you have been involved into it, so how do you see the focus adoption and the focus evolution in the next few years, and how it would help the FinOps practice in the future.
Yeah, so I was part of the Focus Steering Committee over the last year, and we were helping launch 1.2 as well there. Focus really for me was something that is such a necessity towards getting away from just looking at cost in isolation and start to unify this idea of, naturally, whenever I would present, for example, cloud costs to somebody at Citi, the next question would be like, well, can I load my other data to it? Can you contextualize this in the total cost of ownership, right? For example, everything from on-prem to salaries to the cost of our offices, whatever. Because at the end of the day, when you roll up to a business, you're not just looking at cloud costs in isolation, you're thinking about everything else in between. And so where we started with at least was around SaaS platforms, right? Snowflake and MongoDB Atlas, and said, well, we don't need to only have cloud data. This is pretty similar. It's pay as you go, right? We're paying as much as we're consuming. And so for me, focus is one of those things that really helps, instead of having every practitioner figure out their own way of doing this, right? And I gave a talk about this last year that, the inner data model that everyone has in their company is this thing that they think we'll never have to expose externally. You have columns called like billing vendor group ID because you couldn't agree on, what it should be, or account project ID because you have AWS and GCP. So being able to standardize that and not necessarily have everyone reinvent the wheel again and again, I think it'll be really helpful. And then also it'll be helpful to kind of do analysis, right? You can hire data scientists, you can hire engineers who don't have to first understand these four left joins that you do to get your data set. They're like, you're using the standard data that we all agree to, right? So for me, it's one of those things that the adoption is interesting because it's not just that I rip out my existing current data and then I plug in Focus and now I'm good, because what you really just end up doing was updating an API at that point, right? The goal really for me adoption is that people start using Focus as their internal data set, right? They say for even cost data that isn't already coming from a SAS or a CSP that's in this format, the spec really outlines how to think about cost data, right? Categories should be something that are almost like enums, how to think about dates and times, how to think about blah, blah, blah. So the standardization that Focus is describing is not limited just to the stuff that's, partners that are onboarded to. When I was at Citi, I started looking at how can we now leverage this for some of our internal data, right? How can we extend the Focus 43 columns or whatever and add maybe seven or eight that are business context to us, but it's still in the same format. So then when a downstream data analyst is saying, hey, can I get access to the data? I don't have to have an hour phone call with them explaining, yeah, don't ignore that column, but look at that column. They can just read the spec itself and understand what is the purpose of these things.
Yeah, I also agree that the reinventing the wheel finished with focus, especially with the first version being complete, and I think it will help being able to, if it gets to a point where all the TCO, which is very close to, can be estimated from a single focus data set that can be all aggregated and seamlessly integrated, because the company's ecosystems are very complex, and being able to support everything is extremely difficult. But I think that focus is on the good path for that.
Absolutely.
So, thanks for having all these actionable insights. I think people will get a lot from this. I think there is a lot of gems in the podcast. So it was a pleasure to have you today, Amit. Thanks for sharing all this with us.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure talking.
Pleasure to have you, and see you everyone in the next episode. Bye bye.